Call our third case for today, 09AP468B, Office of Lawyer Regulation v. Hannes. On behalf of the complainant, the Office of Lawyer Regulation, is Attorney Crone. You may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Robert Crone. I am here as retained counsel for OLR, and again, it's a privilege to be in front of Your Honors in this Supreme Court. The issue in this case is primarily a sanction issue, but the referee's findings and the stipulations of the parties led to 10 of 13 counts being established as proven. OLR has appealed one dismissal of one count, count 11. The referee's sanction recommendation was 4 months. Mr. Hammes is seeking a 60-day suspension. OLR has consistently urged a 6-month suspension. It's our belief that a 6-month suspension addresses the purposes of lawyer discipline, primarily as it relates to direction to be provided to other attorneys and protection of the integrity of the judicial system. The ABA standards for sanction, I think, are quite instructive in this case. They do not include some of the criteria that Mr. Hammes urges on this court. He's listed a complimentary list of comments by a client, complimentary list of comments by various clients favorable to him. He's emphasized the stress that he was under in his personal and professional life. This is not a medical incapacity case, and the referee in this case and a 24-page decision discounted those claims of stress in 2 sentences. He also has urged that this is a case that should be considered under the progressive discipline standards. We disagree. This is a first offense violation, and the sanction should be based upon the criteria for such an offense and the severity of the violations. The ABA standards that do apply in our belief that are quite critical here relates primarily to the elements of dishonesty. One has to search far and wide to find more instances of lying and deceit and dishonesty in the case than one finds in this case. The referee's report is based upon numerous adverse credibility findings. Mr. Hammes lied to a circuit court judge regarding his eligibility to practice. Mr. Hammes falsified billings to the public defender. Mr. Hammes lied in a petition for reinstatement. Mr. Hammes misled several courts and appeared while his license was suspended. And in addition, up to the very end, Mr. Hammes was found to have lied to the referee in the disciplinary proceedings. This is a serial liar, if you will. This is not an anomaly, as suggested in Mr. Hammes' brief. But his conduct in this regard of deceit and misrepresentation seems to be the norm. We feel strongly about this case. The other ABA criteria in terms of sanctions that are important relate to the number of charges. Here there are 11 that have been proven. 10. We believe 11 should be proved, should be established. Also, there's a pattern of misconduct. There's a pattern of deceit and a continuation of practice under the guise of being eligible to practice, and the misrepresentations to courts, and the elements of pattern of non-cooperation with the OLR. This is a situation where Mr. Hammes' conduct not only was a disservice and disrupted the lives of clients, but more importantly, his conduct is a reflection of his, in our belief, his contempt for the legal system. The case law supports a minimum of 6 months, and that's important here because of the need to reestablish his fitness to practice. And in that instance, in terms of the case law, there's been some suggestion in their brief that the fact that he has not had previous discipline is critical. That's one factor, but there are several cases where there has been a 6-month or greater suspension, where there has been no prior discipline. The Glassbrenner case is a case where there is no prior discipline. An inexperienced cooperative defendant, unlike what we have here, put in some false public defender billings. The Davidson case involved parking fees charged to the public defender that were not incurred. No prior discipline. She received a 6-month suspension. And DeGracie, there was an 8-month suspension. There were no prior charges of discipline, and there were only 6 counts in that case, one including misrepresentation. So we feel the record is very strong here for the imposition of a 6-month or greater suspension. Now, in terms of the OLR's appeal of Count 11, the outcome of our appeal on that case has no bearing on our view of the sanction that should be imposed in this case. Count 11, dealing with the client Tepe, was a 20:1.3 diligence and promptness charge, where, in our view, the referee's findings actually should have led to a proper conclusion that that particular code violation was violated. Her findings are absolutely on target and consistent with the violation. Mr. Hammes was hired in July of 07 to deal with a neighborhood problem. He was to file a complaint. And then we have, over the course of 7 months, emails back and forth where the client is virtually begging him to take some kind of action. And he says, quote, I'll be filing, quote, tomorrow, constantly telling the client, leading the client to believe some action is to be taken. The referee found that the client had asked Mr. Hammes repeatedly to act, and that whatever Mr. Hammes did do, his conduct was unproductive, and he did not prioritize the client's matters. Having gone that far, however, the referee simply stopped at that point and said, well, these things did occur, but the client really wasn't injured because his matter was pursued and it was resolved apart from the representation of Mr. Hammes. And I wish to point out, members of the court, that there is an error in the referee's decision that we incorporated in our brief to the effect that we stated that Mr. Tepe was forced to hire an additional or a second attorney after he discharged Mr. Hammes in that matter. That is not correct. And we apologize for that error on the part of the referee and our part incorporating it into our brief. In any event, if one looks at the total dimensions of the violations in this case, we have, unfortunately, I think, a virtual pathological dimensions of deceitful practices here on the part of Mr. Hammes. Not an isolated affair. Now, it did occur over a very short term of private practice, but Mr. Hammes had only been in private practice for a couple of years. He had been a lawyer for several years, but had worked in a corporate setting. And the rules we're talking about here, although they apply to all lawyers, principally apply to those in private practice in terms of...
Mr. Hammes's brief explains a whole series of circumstances within, I gather, this short period of time.
Yes.
I'm looking at pages 9 through 14 of the brief that explain that he appointed a receiver, and it took three, maybe four times as long as he thought it was going to take, so he was full-time on something he thought was part-time, that his partnership with another lawyer ended, and he was left without an office and had to reorganize, that he had 50, I think was the number, assignments from the public defender office, and in addition to, I think it was 50, if I'm wrong, it says 50 on page 10, that in addition to what appears from what his statement is a full-time job and 50 public defender and problems with a law partner, he also had private clients, and that he simply was on overload and was not psychologically able to cope with the overload. And that I think, as most people know, either practice law or do other things, that once something becomes stale, you don't like to touch it because it's just twice as hard to get back into it. And that's what you have, and you've got these psychological issues with this. And as you say, it was a short period of time. So isn't that a mitigating circumstance?
Well, I think it is a mitigating circumstance. And if this had extended over a longer period of time, we'd be seeking more than a six-month suspension. There's a couple of things there, Chief Justice, and that is that there's no evidence corroborating his comments that he was overloaded, that there's no other people that came forward to testify as to that. Also, there's no evidence that he sought help from anybody else, other lawyers who could ease the burden of his practice or others who could deal with the corporate problems. There's no evidence that he had any adverse health issues, mental or physical, during this period of time or needed any kind of treatment. Also, the fact that there's an overload, I think, would explain neglect, if you would. That would be fairly, as you say, you let something get stale and it only gets worse when it sits. But that's not what we have here. For the most part, we have situations where he's going into court and telling judges that he's licensed to practice, or implying that he's licensed to practice, and then he's...
He said it was taken care of today, and he tried to take care of it, apparently, in the afternoon. Not very appropriately, but, you know, he did. It's an ambiguous statement.
I'm sorry?
I said it's an ambiguous statement. I'm going to take care of it today. And he appears in the morning, if I remember the facts, before Judge Koshnick, and he goes to, he signs up for the afternoon and doesn't attend, and then goes to BBE. Were those the facts? Did I remember them right?
Well, I know that there was some effort to create some ambiguity in that statement. If you read the transcript, and the referee didn't find any ambiguity, and in terms of the credibility issue, I think I prefer to defer to her opinion on that. It's consistent with what our position was. If you read what was said in the context of what was said, there was a specific inquiry of the judge as to whether you're suspended or not, and the implication was that he was not and going to take care of it and all of that, and he practiced. And there were other instances of practicing while suspended. So,
excuse me, just before you leave that point, I thought that he said to the judge, "I cleared it up the previous afternoon." So I guess what was said is perhaps a bit important to me. Do you know if he said he was going to clear it up, or if he said he cleared it up the previous afternoon? And you don't have to stop what you're doing now. You can look when you sit down and then just let me know, because I didn't realize there was going to be a dispute about that.
I have my remaining 5 minutes at the end, if you
That's
don't
fine.
Mind. But,
That's
but
fine,
I know
sure.
that was a defense that was raised. What was said, what was a fair inference from it? And the referee said, in my mind, you misled the judge.
Okay, thank you.
And I can...
You can just
quote
check
chapter and verse later.
Yeah, that's plenty of time.
So, as I say, indeed, there are some mitigating circumstances, but I think in terms of the overall pattern of conduct here, and if you look at the other cases involving 6-month suspension, some of which I mentioned to you, the violations in those instances don't, for the most part, involve the level of misrepresentation and dishonesty as we have here. I think that's what tips this case well into the 6-month suspension situation. And I don't think, as I say, I think neglect and I think failure to communicate and some of those more garden variety violations can be attributed to stress in the workplace. But when you're talking about this kind of thing where you're walking into courts, where you're filing papers to establish your ability to practice with the Board of Professionals, with appropriate licensing people, and you're walking into courts, I think that's a different situation. The other thing is that, at least in the in the Glassbrenner matter, where there was a 6-month suspension for public defender billing irregularities, it was important in that case that the court said that this was an inexperienced attorney who was cooperative. Now, in this instance, Mr. Hammes did have experience in the legal practice, although only a couple of years in the private practice. But I don't think you see much cooperation if you look at this transcript. There were a number of stipulations he entered into, but he continued to defend himself as he had the right to do, but even to the point where the referee made some findings that she did not believe what he was saying at the disciplinary hearing.
Let me get the facts as you see them with regard to what you were just discussing. So as you see them, he appeared, and this is on an appendix 53 of the findings of the referee's report, that as you see them, according to Judge Koshnick's deposition, that Judge Koshnick, and I'm reading, knew of Hammes from the referee's report. Judge Koshnick knew of Hammes' suspension, asked him before the hearing if he cleared it up, and Hammes lied to Judge Koshnick, claiming he had cleared up the matter the previous afternoon. based on Hamas's misrepresentations, Judge Koshnick allowed Hamas to proceed with the scheduling hearing. So you're saying that's that finding, if you will, is something that you think is a correct finding by the referee
in
terms of lying.
That.
Okay. I want to get the – then later that same day, that's when he went to BBE and help me with this. And he filed a petition for reinstatement, but he had claimed that he had completed courses that had not yet been offered. Is that what the referee found?
The course had not begun at the time of the Hamas put in the petition. It was an afternoon, as I recall, it was an afternoon course, and the petition was put in prior to that.
Okay. Then, so they denied the petition because they wouldn't give him credit for something that hadn't yet taken place. And then he filed another petition, and I think also with BBE, indicating in that petition he hadn't practiced during his suspension. And then the referee said that there were six separate clients that he had made appearances on during his suspension.
He did not disclose it should have been disclosed, yes.
Did any of those judges ask him about his status?
There's nothing in the record on that. All we have is that his status is being suspended and his appearing in court, and I don't know one way or the other as to whether an inquiry was made of that. There's nothing in this record on that subject.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so in conclusion, unless there are other questions, OLR does feel that this is a case that warrants a minimum of a 6-month suspension because of the severity of the number of charges, the severity of them, and the fact that, for the most part, they involve a considerable pattern and habitual deceit and misrepresentation to people, particularly courts of record in this state, and that's something that's of great concern to OLR. Thank you.
I have another question. Is there any consideration that's appropriate for this court to give with regard to the state public defender investigation in overbilling? I think there were 93 cases that they were investigating. We only have one in front of us. And the referee said there was a violation with regard to that one particular case. What, if any, consideration beyond that can this court appropriately give with regard to the other overbillings that were alleged?
I don't think that would be appropriate to consider those. That's not a part of our proof. We prove the violations in the one matter, irregularities in billing for services that were not performed. As it turned out, there was testimony that happened in other cases. We didn't urge that in our brief to be a factor in discipline, and we're not urging that here today. Thank you.
Mr. Pines, representing Mr. Harris.
May it please the court, I'm Lester Pines. I represent James Hamas. I appealed not from the findings of the referee. We have only appealed on the issue of sanction. Mr. Hamas believes that the referee gave him a fair hearing on the issues. He conceded 5 of the counts that were alleged. In his answer, he conceded the violations. He contested six of the violations. The referee found in his favor on three of the six that he contested and found against him on three. Before I address the issue of a sanction on our appeal, I do want to talk a little bit about some of the factual questions that the court raised during Mr. Crone's argument. In particular, the issue of what was said to Judge Koshnick. Mr. Hammes's testimony at the hearing, which the referee found was not credible, was that he said to Judge Koshnick, I'm going to take care of it this afternoon. Judge Koshnick's testimony in his deposition was that Mr. Hammes had said to him, I had taken care of it this morning. The referee's finding was that she found that Judge Koshnick said he had taken care of it this afternoon. I think if you look at Judge Koshnick's deposition, you'll see that he did make that statement in his deposition, but then on cross-examination, he recognized that he had misspoken and that he said, Mr. Hammes said, I had taken care of it this morning. It's really a distinction without a difference in the sense that either way, there was a misrepresentation to Judge Koshnick. And we're not contesting that. Nor are we contesting the fact that there were misrepresentations made to the Board of Bar Examiners. And these are findings that the court will accept, that Mr. Hammes accepts. Our position is that OLR's view of Mr. Hammes is vastly overblown. And its expression here today, that his lying is of pathological dimensions, is a perfect example of how overblown OLR's view of Mr. Hammes is and explains why OLR would seek a six-month suspension in this case. The evidence before the referee that was unrebutted by OLR was that at this period of time in the year of 2007, particularly the spring and into the summer, that James Hammes had taken on an obligation to be a receiver of a company in far northern Wisconsin that blew up into a vast amount of work. It's unrebutted that he was overextended. It's unrebutted that he had this terrible problem where his partner left one night, took everything, left him without an office. These are just the background facts, though. They don't explain the particular conduct with regard to misrepresentation. But I want you to look at those background facts and to put his conduct into a context, because these things happen within a short space of time. And I think if you would ask Mr. Hammes, who is here today in court with me, obviously you can't ask him, but if you would ask him and you'd say to him, why did you do this? I mean, you get a letter from the Board of Bar Examiners that says you're suspended because you're missing one credit. You've done 29 credits in the 2 years. You need one credit. And he would tell you that the dumbest thing I ever did was not to just tell everybody, hey, I'm suspended. Go out, get the credit, file the petition, and be done with it. But he didn't do that. He made a fundamental error in judgment, which was to try to get through this without having to tell his clients that he was suspended. And that started him down a path which led him to make a series of false statements. All because he didn't just take the bull by the horns and deal with the problem. And that is the same thing that people do lawyers or other people do. And it's wrong. I mean, if you owe somebody money and they call you up and they say, we haven't gotten your payment, and you say, well, the check's in the mail. And it's not true, but you know you're going to put the check in the mail. What Jim Hammes did is that same thing, only expanded, and every time that he took a step, something else went wrong, and every time something else went wrong, instead of taking a step back and saying, I've got to just deal with this, he continued to try to talk his way out of this problem, and he talked his way into a bigger and bigger and bigger problem.
Mr. Pines, what is the time period that we're talking about? We're talking about, from, say,
April. This particular time frame involving the Board of Bar Examiners and Judge Koshnick, that was in, if I recall correctly, it was in June. But the whole, the issues with the partnership, the overextension at ProWeld, really went through April through June of 2007. It's a fairly small space of time.
So we're talking about just a couple of months?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that says to the BBE, but there are other charges here.
I know that there are other charges.
I just want to...
And I'm particularly addressing the charges of misrepresentation because I think the charges of misrepresentation are the most serious charges.
Right.
If we were dealing with the charges of neglect of a client's case... In the absence of these misrepresentation charges, I think that OLR would have probably agreed either to a private reprimand or to a public reprimand. They would not have sought a suspension. But I think OLR's position is, and I think the referee's position most clearly was, that they sought a suspension because of the misrepresentation issues.
What about the billing that was a misrepresentation as well? Where did that fit time-wise?
That fit... over a period of time in 2007, and the facts that were presented to the referee were not only that the facts were presented in the testimony was that, and the court should note, the State Public Defender's Office did not make a complaint to OLR about Mr. Hammes. The State Public Defender's Office met with Mr. Hammes about these billings, and this is in the record. And said, there's a problem with these billings. There's a problem with the way you're billing on your cases. And they came to a complete resolution of all of the issues with regard to the billings, which resulted in a substantial reduction in the amount of money that Mr. Hammes was paid. They did not then make a complaint about his billing practices. OLR, in the course of the investigation, when it was made aware of this issue with Mr. Hammes and OLR on its own, decided to bring a claim.
Didn't that also result in his removal from the SPD list?
It resulted with his agreeing to no longer do SPD cases, yes. That was a voluntary agreement on his part. And it was a wise agreement on his part because he had taken on too many cases for the Public Defender's Office.
Billing for 15 hours a day?
That is what the referee found in that instance. And that, I believe, reflects the total disorganization of Mr. Hammes' practice. And one of the other backdrops in this whole case is that Mr. Hammes, operating as a sole practitioner, really was running an office after his partner left that was quite disorganized, and it took him some time to organize it. That's not an excuse. That's part of an explanation as a background to this. But in any case,
what kind of a sanction do you think we should issue?
The sanction should be a 60-day suspension.
And in the 60-day suspension, he doesn't have to petition to get back in, right?
That's
His
correct.
License is automatically
That's correct.
Given back.
Okay.
Through 4 months, too.
That's true of 4 months also.
The difference is 2 months.
The difference is 2 months. It's a lot of time when you're in private practice, when you're a sole practitioner.
Right.
So the issue, I think, before the court is, How does the court in this case apply the principles of progressive discipline? The principles of progressive discipline do not require the court to start in a disciplinary case at the lowest level of discipline. The lowest level of discipline that the court could do would be a public reprimand. This court has made a determination that once conduct reaches the level where there should be a suspension, that the lowest level of suspension is 60 days. So there's no discretion between the lowest level of discipline and 60 days. So when we look at this in terms of progressive discipline, we have to look at the fact that the court, once the court decides to go to a suspension, that it's a serious sanction. 60 days is 1/6 of a year. It's a serious sanction where the office has to be shut down, a lawyer cannot practice. It's not a trifle. The purpose of discipline is corrective and not punitive. And so the question in this case would be, is 60 days a sufficient amount of a penalty to correct Mr. Hamas's behavior, to ensure that he doesn't engage in this behavior again? But there's also a punitive, part of a sanction. It's not all just corrective, because the punitive aspect of it connects with the corrective part. Is 60 days sufficiently punitive for a person who is a sole practitioner who will not be able to practice for that amount of time, who will not have income for that amount of time? And I assert to the court that 60 days is a very substantial punitive sanction. And then we get to the issue which actually is sort of reminiscent of what we have to address in criminal court, which is this sanction enough for general deterrence for other lawyers who might read this case and say, well, if you can do all this and only get a 60-day suspension, I guess I could do this. I mean, I actually think that when you're dealing with lawyers and disciplinary matters, that the notion of general deterrence really is not a factor at all. I just can't imagine that lawyers would look at this and say, well, this is what I can get away with and only get a 60-day suspension. That just doesn't add up.
What about the trust and confidence of the public for the bar, and that there's adequate sanction for people who offend? And it's not only lying to the court. You know, we don't look favorably on that. But it's not only questionable billing, which comes out of my tax dollars, or the public's tax dollars. We don't look favorably on that. But there were other charges of not handling clients' matters promptly and adequately, whether or not there was damage. I mean, there were those charges, too. And what does the public say when you got a combination of all of that and there's a 60-day suspension? Does it look like a slap on the wrist or a big nothing? And should I care about that?
Well, I can't presume to speak for the public.
No, I don't have any empirical evidence.
I think that to the extent that the public pays attention to this, the fact that a lawyer is suspended from practice is what the public would look at. That is, that the Supreme Court has said to a licensed lawyer, for the next 60 days, you're not a lawyer anymore.
Yeah, we've lifted your license.
Yeah, and I think that's what the public will see, and know that that's significant. 60 days without income for anybody is a significant sanction. So I don't think that, you know, how would we put it in terms in criminal court, depreciate the seriousness of the offense? I don't think that a 60-day sanction depreciates the seriousness of the offense, because I think if the court looks at the totality of the cases that it's had, that this falls well within the range of what the court has previously done in circumstances that involve misrepresentation and in circumstances where there has not been a prior offense. Now, OLR says, well, although Mr. Hammes has been licensed for 20 years, well, we're not going to count any of the other time when he was a lawyer because he wasn't in private practice. We're only going to count this space of time when he's in private practice. I don't think that's fair. Lawyers' conduct as a corporate counsel counts. So you have a lawyer who has many, many years of practice without any problems, without any complaints. That counts for something. It's significant. And if he were a pathological liar, as OLR has asserted today, that certainly would have shown up earlier in his career.
I don't know about pathological liar. I'm not sure what that means. I'm going to ask you, though, as I did your opposing counsel, what, if any, import we give to these other acts, for want of a better phrase. By that, I mean we have the deposition transcript of Judge Koshnick, where the referee said there was finding that he lied to Judge Koshnick. But what about the six other times that he appeared in someone's court? And we don't have transcripts, and maybe there was no one calling him on that. But by his presence, he is misrepresenting. He is misrepresenting that he is eligible to be there when he isn't. What about those alleged 93 other overbilling cases, several of which, according to the testimony, because that's in the referee's report, several of which had, many of which had over 15-hour days billed. And I say to myself, is this the kind of character, in terms of character and fitness, is this, this reflects poorly on his character and his fitness. Nevertheless, they're not subject of the actual counts. So what, if any, import do I bring to those six other appearances and the potentially 93 other cases of overbilling? And how does that fit in with the fitness to practice?
Well, first of all, OLR has not alleged that there were violations resulting from that. Second of all, the state public defender, and the record, I should say, is fairly limited in terms of what it was that was going on with the state public defender. The state public defender did not see fit to make a complaint. Mr. Hammes had, I think the record shows, had numerous meetings to discuss the billings and resolved most of the billing issues. So in the absence of a more developed record, I think it would be unfair to assume that there were misrepresentations in those billings.
The SPD, according to Appendix 63, did file a complaint with OLR regarding Hammes, but it was regarding his possibly appearing and representing state public defender-appointed clients when he was suspended.
Right.
And I think that's how then they got on to, and the state public defender testified regarding the Hill bill and then other bills
right.
and stuff. So that's how they got into that. There was a complaint filed, but not on overbilling, but on appearing.
That's correct. Now, of course, Justice Bradley, the record is very clear that the state public defender had extensive discussions with Mr. Hamas, came to a resolution with Mr. Hamas. The resolution did not include an agreement by the state public defender not to make an OLR complaint. So I think that one can make the inference, frankly, that if OLR did not make a complaint about the billings and did not claim that they were misrepresentations, one could infer that they were not misrepresentations. I mean, it goes both ways. So I think basically that entire issue either should not be considered or should be considered in favor of Mr. Hamas.
My problem is that it is part of the report, and quotes are in the report from the testimony and stuff. And yet,
yeah, there is quote there on that issue of the one bill. But I think it would be we did not have an opportunity to defend against claims that were not made. And I think it would be improper for the court to make an inference from claims that were not made and were not litigated, that Mr. Hamas engaged in some lengthy kind of conduct involving misrepresentation. I did want to respond to your statement about his appearances after having been suspended. I mean, they speak for themselves. He should not have done that. That was improper. And he conceded that. He conceded those claims. He recognized that he should have immediately stopped practicing, but he didn't do it.
Pines, you want to create some context for a number of these offenses. And part of the context is his partnership with another lawyer abruptly ended when she cleaned out their offices overnight, leaving him to find a new office space. The inference that I draw from that is that the fault of that was the other lawyer. Is that a fair inference? Or is that not the inference you wish?
It's a fair inference that's an improper way to end up an arrangement with another lawyer. Yes. That his former partner, if she desired to terminate the partnership, shouldn't have come one night and taken everything out of the office and left, leaving Mr. Hamas high and dry.
Well, are you saying there was no cause for that?
The record doesn't reflect the cause for that, and we didn't go into that. And I'm not going to speculate on what her motivations were, but that's what happened.
Well, now, I have driven from Madison to Antigo many times. That's a long drive.
It is a long drive.
Now, the headquarters of the practice was in Stoughton?
Yes.
And
well, it was in Milton at the time, and then Stoughton.
Milton? Milton to Antigo is a long drive. Why did he want to become the receiver and the chief operating officer of this company?
Well, Mr. Hamas's background was in running companies, as well as being a lawyer. He was asked to do this. He was recommended. He took on that obligation. He was a receiver in order to protect the interest of a spouse in a divorce. He undertook that. And to his credit, and I think he explained this in his testimony, when he got there, it turned out to be a very difficult assignment, and he felt an obligation to protect the interest of that person. And he met his obligation, but it was really to the detriment of the rest of his practice. What he probably should have done is said, I can't do this anymore. Someone else is going to have to do this. I think the record does reflect that he was successful in protecting the quite substantial interest that this ex-wife of the owner had in that business.
But didn't in effect he devote his time and energy to protecting one client over a lot of other clients?
Well, I think that you could conclude that fairly, that he. And what he was trying to do was to deal with that one client and deal with the rest of his clients at the same time. And that, in fact, is the appropriate context within which to see that. That is where as a sole practitioner, he should have stepped back and said, I am overextended, I've got to stop this. One of the difficulties of practicing by yourself is that you don't have somebody else to go to and say, what do you think I should do? Because there are a lot of times in practice when it's very helpful to go and be able to say, what do you think I should do? This is the course of action that I intend to take. And they say to you, you don't want to do that. You haven't thought of this, you haven't thought of this, and you haven't thought of that. And when you're a sole practitioner, you don't have that kind of feedback. And it really creates difficulties, a very difficult thing to do. That doesn't excuse the choices that Mr. Hammes made. It just puts them in a context. And I'll reserve what time I have, because I think I have an opportunity, because there's a cross appeal, to have some rebuttal, but I'm not sure.
Your cross appeal was on sanction.
We were actually the appellant on sanction.
Right. And then, I know. I saw that and wondered how you were going to all proceed. Do you have any objection to that, Attorney Crone? Okay. You will have some time, though.
Thank you.
You have five.
Yeah, I said I would raise this.
And I'll give Mr. Pines five, which is approximately what he had left if the yellow light hadn't been on too long.
Let me ask, is there going to be back and forth discussion on count 11?
I shouldn't respond. I thought there was no appeal on 11.
There was.
Yes, there was.
Is that right, appeal?
Yes. Yes, and I did address that already.
Okay. You appealed that.
I appealed that, right.
I'm sorry.
When I got here today, I thought I'd be going second, and so here I am.
I understand that.
I don't necessarily go last. But.
All the charges that were found, Mr. Pines is not challenging. All the charges, that's why I responded that way. The referee did not find in your favor on count 11, and that's your appeal. So you have two issues. Count 11 and the sanction.
Correct.
Okay. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about sanction.
Okay.
I didn't hear anything in response to count 11, and I'll let him have his say on that, and I don't need to respond to that.
Is the sanction, figure sanction, appropriate even if count 11 falls?
Oh, I think the sanction should be 6 months suspension, whether or not there's a violation of count 11.
Right. That's what I'm asking you.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm confident the court can distinguish between lawyer's rhetoric and the record in this case. And to the extent I used words that were characterized as being vastly overblown, I apologize for that. But the fact of the matter is this record speaks for itself in terms of dishonesty. And I provided the Chronicle and the listing of all the separate events and all the separate forms and all the separate occasions for this, and we think it's serious, whether it's something – whether another adjective or adverb would better apply is not for me to say. As far as this being a cascading series of events that led Mr. Hammes to this conduct in a short period of time, that people do these things under pressure, well, I beg to differ. People don't do these things under pressure. Lawyers in private practice face pressure. Lawyers in all kinds of practice face daily pressure and daily stress. And if you're up against the wall, you seek help. There's many facilities through the bar. There's other attorneys and communities that are more than willing to help private practitioners. And all you have to do is pick up the phone and get help and farm out some of your work if it's getting to be too much. It's as simple as that. As far as the public defender issue, this case doesn't turn on whether or not the state public defender filed a complaint. OLR found the violations to be serious enough to represent disciplinary rules, and the referee found them to be serious enough to represent disciplinary rules, regardless of how this matter came to the attention of this court. And the billing was characterized, Hammes' billing in terms of public defender, public funds cases were described as being out of control, involving 15-hour days. And there was a certain amount of compromising on several cases, one of them being one of these matters, and that was resolved on a financial basis. But there were misrepresentations as to the work that was allegedly being performed that was not performed in this case, and that's what the referee found.
I don't know if that's what, in this one particular case, in the Hill billing.
In the Hill matter. in the Hill matter as it relates to this case.
As opposed to Hill billing.
I'm sorry.
Nothing.
I think counsel, and I appreciate that, responded in terms of the series of events with Judge Koskinek. I don't know if Justice Rogenstack, if you need anything further on that, but I think he fairly summarized what was said on that occasion. And Judge Koskinek testified in his deposition, and the referee listened to the Hamas explanation, read the deposition, and came to the conclusion that she did. Now, in conclusion, I agree with Mr. Pines when he talks about the primary purpose of lawyer discipline to be corrective in nature. But how can we be sure that there's been any kind of a correction here if there's a 60-day suspension or a suspension that's short of 6 months? We just wait out our time. Mr. Hamas returns to practice. We throw caution to the wind. What has he learned? How has he reformed his practices? What's going to happen here?
But with that has to be answered with a 4 month. That only has to be answered with a 6 month. Is that your point?
That's my point. My point is that a 6 month is only going to provide the kind of purposeful, meaningful assurance, if you will, to this court and to lawyers across the state that, in fact, there has been corrective action. Now, if you read this transcript, Mr. Hamas is pretty darn defiant over all of these counts. How can we make sure he's rehabilitated himself unless he comes before a referee after a 6 month suspension saying, in a sense, that he understands what happened, it's not going to happen again, that he's had counseling, maybe he's had stress management, whatever it takes. Baseball pitchers go get stress management counseling these days. There are all kinds of options that can...
What about law office management techniques?
Pardon me?
What about a course in law office management?
Law office management, some way to manage his practice, some way to assure that if these kinds of situations develop where he's overloaded, he's got some kind of relief valve, some kind of system in place that's going to take care of it. Members of the court, Mr. Pines is absolutely correct. Corrective action is what is needed here. But we can't be sure there's been corrective action unless there is a 6 month suspension.
So your recommendation is really tied to the fact that with 6 months, he has to apply to get in again, to get his license reinstated fully. And with 4 months or 2 months, he's just back in after the time has run. Is that the?
That's correct.
And so that's why you chose the 6 months.
Well, I didn't choose it.
No, I understand that. I'm talking about your client.
OLR chooses it, and I follow their orders.
Okay, but that, as you understand it, is the genesis of the...
I think that's a fair reading of it, interpreting what they think. I think they think it's a serious enough problem. For an additional 2 months, you can have the benefit of knowing what's been done in terms of his practice and his attitude about all these things. Thank you.
Well, may I ask one more question? I want to make sure I understand.
Professor?
The 6 months requires the attorney to reapply.
Yes.
And are you saying that the application for readmittance to the bar will require reporting of certain things or the stating of certain things, and that is what is necessary here?
Yes, I think... I don't claim to be an expert on this, but it seems to me in the reapplication process, you have to assure the referee and the people hearing the application that you're fit to resume the practice of law and respond to the necessary questions that lead to that conclusion. It's an open hearing. People can come forward to testify on your behalf or against you. And this court then reviews what a referee does. And at least from my experience, it's been fairly meaningful in terms of attorneys having to reestablish that they know what the rules are and they intend to follow them. And they understand what's happened in the past.
One of the concerns that is often present here in the court is that when there's a 6 month suspension, it usually takes almost a year after that 6 months to actually reapply, irrespective of what the attorney's been doing.
Well, I'm sure that's a concern. I'm sure that's a concern of OLR. If I talk about 6 months, I would hope it would be 6 months. I don't the system is such that it takes longer than that. I would hope it could be streamlined in some fashion at some point. I don't have the answer to that, but that is a problem. I know that attorneys are concerned about that, and I know the all our people are concerned about it. And to the extent that that can be streamlined or it can be advanced or stepped up, that would be certainly better. But I don't know what else to say about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crone. Mr. Pines? Can you respond on sanctions?
Yes, and I will be brief. The record does have in it testimony from Mr. Hammes about the changes that he made to his practice. These issues arose in 2007. This is 2010. Mr. Hammes testified about getting a secretary, about the computer support, about a variety of things that he's done to make sure that he doesn't get overextended again. Despite the fact that OLR denigrated the testimony of the clients who came in to testify on his behalf, there is in the record clients who came in to testify subsequent to these allegations who've said how happy they are with Mr. Hammes and how honest Mr. Hammes has been with them and in dealing with their problems. I think it would be extraordinary under these circumstances in this case as compared to other cases to impose a six-month suspension with a requirement that he petitioned to have his license back. That is an extraordinary disciplinary act which really deviates from other cases. And the other cases where there have been six-month suspensions, there have been prior disciplines of some sort. And those lawyers have been given a chance, and they've failed. And they violated again. Then they got a six-month suspension.
That's not true in all cases.
It's not true in all cases. It's true in many cases. There are a few cases that we were able to find, and I think OLR cited them. There are a few cases where the initial discipline was 6 months. But I think when we look at those cases and compare them to this case, the conduct in those cases was far worse. But in the generally, there has been prior discipline. And that's why I talked about progressive discipline, because the concept of progressive discipline is designed to give a lawyer a chance. A chance to correct behavior. And Mr. Hammes, I believe, has already corrected the behaviors, but this gives him a sanction and it gives him a chance. A six-month suspension essentially will put him out of the practice of law permanently. There is no person who has a sole practice who can be suspended for 6 months and then go through a year's worth of petitioning to be reinstated. That's a drastic remedy. It is not necessary in this case, and it will not be in accordance with the court's preference for progressive discipline. And I'm not just using that phrase over and over again because it's a catchphrase, and it's a phrase that has meaning. It has meaning. It's applied in all kinds of contexts, and this court has chosen to apply it in the context of attorney discipline. So that a sanction of suspension as a first imposition of discipline is serious, and it will be serious for Mr. Hammes. But to jump from a sanction of suspension to a six-month sanction of suspension is far beyond what is necessary here and really is not in accordance with the principles of progressive discipline. He deserves a chance, despite the assertion that he's been defiant about this, which he has not been. He admitted most of his conduct and contested things that he could contest and legitimately contested. Half of those were in his favor. He's not been defiant. And he has done the things, as the record shows, to correct the problems with his practice. 60 days is more than ample. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pines. Thank you, Attorney Crone. As both of you know, because you've appeared before the court in OLR cases, these are always very difficult for the court, and we appreciate your handling of these matters as you have, and we appreciate that you, Mr. Hammes, have come here, and it's not easy for you either. So that will end our hearing in 09-AP-468-D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus James E. Hammes. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when it will have a third day of oral argument in September. We are in recess. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:05.